Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 21st of June, these are our main stories. Kenyan police are accused of using excessive force to disperse mass demonstrations over proposed tax hikes. As the US military resumes aid deliveries from its pier off the coast of Gaza, doctors say severe dehydration and malnutrition are a growing concern among children. Parts of southern China have once-in-a-century flooding, while the north is hit by extreme temperatures and drought. Also in this podcast, how wild chimpanzees seek out medicinal plants.
We sent them to a lab in Germany and we tested for their medicinal properties. 88% of them had strong antibacterial properties and 33% had strong anti-inflammatory properties.
And a world-first conference on how menstruation and the menopause are linked with mental health. This time yesterday on the Global News Podcast, we were reporting on a tense situation in the Kenyan capital Nairobi during big protests, mainly by young people, against proposed tax increases. Today, the authorities are investigating reports that a protester was fatally shot by police during those demonstrations. Lobby groups have said at least 200 people were injured across the country and accused the police of using excessive force. Let's hear from Nairobi and our correspondent there, Mercy Juma.
I was actually one of the reporters who were in the Nairobi CBD covering this protest and have covered many protests, but I've never seen anything like this. There were tens of thousands of people on the street, young people, but they were very peaceful. In my opinion, and from where I stood, nobody was throwing stones. Yes, they were being repelled by the police, but they were moving away and then they kept coming back. It was a bit of a push and pull between them and the police. But when evening drew near and this contentious bill that they're protesting against was passed through the second reading and now it's waiting to the third reading, that's where they became a bit enraged, but still not being violent. But as darkness came, police became a bit more aggressive and we started hearing reports of people being shot at, people being physically abused by the police. And now we confirm that one person has died, so many people have been injured, and those who have been arrested and a couple who are still missing.
Because we're questioning yesterday the use of riot police, police on horseback, water cannon, and asking whether that was disproportionate to the protest that was there. And what Anne had to say about it was that that's just how the Kenyan police operate when they're trying to disperse a protest.
Unfortunately, yes, that's the Kenyan police for you. That's how they operate. But it was really disproportionate because keeping in mind the kind of crowd that they were dealing with, the people that were on the street were 18, 19, 20, 25-year-olds, I would say a couple of 30-year-olds, but most of them were just children. So basically they were fighting children. But unfortunately, children who are very knowledgeable about what they want, about the kind of future they want, and they were doing all this when these young people were live streaming. So that's also the other nature that the protest took. The young people had their phones, they were live streaming their protests. They were outrightly airing their demands. But unfortunately, this was received with so much force from the security forces.
So we're now promised an investigation, and no doubt there'll be more protests because the bill's been passed. The issue hasn't gone away. The protesters aren't going to go away.
Nope, they're not going to go away. So the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, that is IPOA, and this is the authority, the body that monitors and investigates all policing operations affecting members of the public, has said it's going to investigate this. But that just doesn't mean Kenyans and these young people are sitting and waiting. They have actually just released a few minutes ago a seven-day, what they called 7 days of courage, that they're starting this afternoon. So they are going to join Muslims for prayers this afternoon. And then tomorrow, at the entertainment joins, they are planning to have a moment of silence and shout anti government and anti-President William Ruto chants. And then they are planned for two major protests on Tuesday next week when Parliament is supposed to vote on this bill. And then on Thursday, as they wait for the President to either assent to this bill or send it back to Parliament. So it is going to be a very busy next couple of days for the country.
Our correspondent Mercy Juma with me from Nairobi. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is getting worse as the war continues between Israel and Hamas. The UN says around 1 million people are set to face the highest levels of starvation by mid-July. Amid soaring temperatures and a lack of clean water, doctors say severe dehydration, malnutrition and disease are a growing concern, especially among young children. Against that backdrop, the US says it's re-established a temporary pier constructed by its military, allowing a resumption of aid deliveries. Our correspondent John Donison is in Jerusalem. I asked John whether the re-establishment of the US pier to deliver aid into Gaza by sea would make any difference.
The pier has been beset by problems, really, since it opened a month ago. It cost $230 million to build, but it's thought it's only really been operational for about 10 days over the past month. It was closed down last week because of rough seas. Well, it's now up and running again, and US Central Command says some 6,000 metric tons of aid were delivered via the pier yesterday. Aid agencies, though, still say that by far the most efficient and effective way to get aid in would be for Israel to open up more land crossing. Israel insists that it is allowing 200 trucks a day, roughly, through the Kerem Shalom crossing into southern Gaza. But the aid agencies face problems with getting to that aid. One, because of the continued fighting in southern Gaza, and also now such is the level of desperation amongst Gazans that there is a real problem with the aid trucks being looted once they get into Gaza, often by armed gunmen.
And it doesn't look like there's going to be any great shift in terms of Israel suddenly allowing a lot more aid to be delivered by land for all sorts of reasons. How immediate the need for that aid is.
Yeah, it is immediate. I mean, it's hot here, nearly 40 degrees down in Gaza, certainly high 30s. And with many people living in tents, you can only imagine how sweltering they get throughout the day. Now, I don't know how much water you're meant to drink a day, but I'd say in hot conditions, at least a litre, probably 2 litres. And people simply aren't getting it. And what all water there is often is contaminated, and then people, especially young children, end up with gastric infections, diarrhea, chronic dehydration, losing lots and lots of weight. So yeah, the hospitals already dealing with large number of injured people are now facing people with malnutrition and severe dehydration.
Our correspondent John Donison in Jerusalem. Officials in northwest Pakistan have deployed additional security forces after a tourist accused of blasphemy was killed by a mob. The crowd attacked a police station and seized the man, killing him and setting fire to his body on Thursday. Here's our South Asia editor Anbarasan Ethirajan.
The victim was staying in a hotel in Madian, a town in Pakistan's Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, when some locals accused him of blasphemy. The police intervened, rescuing him and taking him to the local office. But reports said the crowd converged on the station, pelting officers with stones, dragging the man out and beating him to death. Several people were injured in the violence. The situation is reported to be tense, with protesters blocking the main road. Blasphemy is a sensitive subject in Muslim-majority Pakistan, where even accusations without evidence can stir up anger among crowds, leading to lynchings.
Next, to the forests of Uganda. The sound of wild chimpanzees playing. They were recorded by scientists from Oxford University who are staying to investigate how these primates use certain plants to self-medicate when they're ill or in pain. My colleague Mishal Hussain spoke to the lead researcher of the project, Dr. Elodie Fryman.
I lived in the Bodongo forest for a total of around 8 months, and I was watching carefully what the chimps were eating and doing, and I was also taking health data to see if they were suffering from any sort of bacterial infection or parasite load, or if they had any sort of injuries or wounds. And then I would look at what they ate carefully in their diet and select any resources or plants that it looked like they were going out of their way to collect, or if they were rare or unusual in some way.
And were they?
Yeah, well, so that was what was super exciting about this project, was that we got the opportunity to then take those plant samples. We took 13 different species and we sent them to a lab in Germany, and we tested for their medicinal properties. And we found that 88% of them had strong antibacterial properties and 33% had strong anti-inflammatory properties.
Were these plants known for that, or were they plants that were new to researchers like you or to the pharmaceutical industry?
It's a great question. Many of them are new. most of them have never before been proposed as a medicine for the chimpanzees. So our research vastly expands what we know or what we think we know about the chimpanzee medicinal repertoire.
So tell me more about exactly what you observe. So is it, I don't know, do chimps do things like clutch their stomach or look like they have a stomachache, and then do they go for a certain plant and appear to get better after eating it?
Sometimes it's very clear that the chimp is suffering from something. They might, I mean, chimps like us will sneeze or cough if they have a respiratory infection. But other times we had to use other sort of non-invasive health monitoring methods, like taking samples and seeing if they tested for any sort of abnormal metrics, like if they had a bacterial infection. We were quantifying how many parasites we found in their samples. And then to get a sense of what they were eating, we looked at plants that, again, were not normal part of their diet. Chimps will avoid eating things that are unusual to them. Usually they're quite, the word is neophobic, scared of new foods. So in these cases where they would seek out unusual foods, especially when they were sick or wounded, it raised a lot of alarm bells for us.
And did the plants generally work? Was it the case that without intervention from people like you, a chimpanzee could be cured of their infection through a plant that they ate in the forest?
Yeah, so in all cases, the chimps that we found were suffering from some sort of illness or wound did recover. It's hard to, you know, 100% pinpoint that and attribute it to the plant that they were eating, but every single chimp showed a fast recovery after eating these plants.
Dr. Elodie Fryman from Oxford University. In the UK, there's a big conference taking place on a subject that directly affects half the world's population, menstrual health and the menopause. It's bringing together international experts from a range of academic disciplines, including psychology, medicine, policy studies and law. The aim is to research an area which some say is still underfunded and poorly understood. The organiser, Professor Gemma Sharp from the University of Exeter, told us why she set the conference up.
The field in general has been historically very underfunded, and people were working on menstrual health and on mental health and on menopausal health, but in silos. So they were working, thinking from their own perspectives, their own, using their own skills. And we didn't really have a community. So when I came to the research field, that was the issue that I saw. And so I just started reaching out to different people that I knew were working in these areas. And it just kind of snowballed from there. So now we're all brought together so that we can share those perspectives and collaborate on projects, but not just academics, but also bringing in non-academics as well, who are actually more kind of working on the ground with women and people who menstruate, so that we can get our research findings out there and they can actually have an impact and improve the lives of those people. And there's a lot of research around the timing of menopause again and menopausal experiences. But then in between, we don't really think about menstruation. It's just not something that people have been researching that much. So now it's really great to see people looking at that a little bit more, looking at menstruation in the workplace, etc. And that's one of the themes that has come out from the conference, I think, is that we really need to take this life course approach to think about these things throughout the whole reproductive life course. We had a really fascinating panel discussion, and we were discussing what the problems and the reasons that we haven't been having this joined up thinking. And essentially, we've just not been talking to each other. So it's been really great to get everybody all in the room at the same time. So we had people like from the femtech company Clue, people from the charity Wellbeing of Women. And they were saying it's been incredible to see all of the research going on in this area. We didn't know that this was happening. And then on our side, we're kind of saying, well, we're doing all this research and we don't know how to get our findings out of this. But I think why it's been underfunded is the huge amount of stigma around just talking about menstrual health. Another thing that's come out of the conference is we're all united in knowing that we need to break down those barriers and that stigma. One thing that I think we agree on is that the education would be a really good place to start with that, and just normalising menstruation so that people from a really young age, even pre-menstruation, boys and girls, understand that this is a kind of normal process, and just removing that like embarrassing, squeamish nature attached to it.
Professor of Psychology, Gemma Sharp. Still to come on the Global News Podcast. We're in Stonehenge in southwest England to mark the summer solstice, the longest period of daylight in the Northern Hemisphere. a Ukrainian brigade that's been redeployed to help defend the strategic eastern town of Chasiv Yar from a concerted Russian assault, says fighting there has become extremely difficult. It said Russia's army was trying to encircle the town. Jean McKenzie is in Kyiv.
If the Russians can successfully capture Chasiv Yar, which is strategically located on top of a hill, it would put a number of key Ukrainian cities within sight and make it easier for Russia to push forward and achieve one of its main aims of this war, to occupy the entire region of Donetsk. Units from Ukraine's 24th Separate Mechanized Brigade that have been redeployed to the town said Russian forces were trying to encircle it, attacking it from the north and south. But up in the northeast of Ukraine, the situation around the city of Kharkiv has stabilized after Russian troops crossed the border in May.
The Chinese authorities have called it a once-in-a-century event as torrential rain causes flash flooding and mudslides in the south. Tens of thousands of people have had to leave their homes. Several have been killed. More heavy rain is expected in the coming days. I've been talking to our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
Flooding is no big deal in southern China. It happens every year. There's an annual flooding season when we get monsoon rains. Now, what's key here is that the government is saying this is a historic moment. We are seeing, for example, in the province of Guangdong, the most populous province in China, 127 million people live there, the same population as Japan has, for example. So a lot of China's economy is focused down in that province as well. They are experiencing floodwaters they have never, ever seen before. So rivers bursting their banks on the scale they've never experienced before. And that's causing some jaw-dropping images. I was looking at some videos today. Some towns and villages look like they've been hit by earthquakes. The heavy rain has been so hard, so many buildings damaged, toppled over. We've seen videos where bridges have been just pushed over by the force of water running through rivers, landslides just collapsing on top of highways. So even though the authorities there are used to dealing with floods, the people there are well used to dealing with floods at this time of year, this is something that they have not experienced.
And the infrastructure obviously can't cope. Perhaps no infrastructure could cope with what you're describing, but anything that's beyond normal boundaries is a challenge in any part of the world.
That's exactly right. And you're also just seeing people just experiencing misery on a really human level, you know, wading through knee-deep mud, or you're seeing people wading through chest-high water, holding their children above them. You know, so I will say the authorities, I think, are quite happy that they've been able to prevent mass deaths so far. So we've had 9 dead in the past week. 6 are still missing, particularly around the Meizhou city area in Guangdong. But compare that to back in 1998 when we had more than 4,000 deaths in a flooding season. So I think on that scale, the authorities have done quite well to move people to higher ground. But still, the depth of the destruction here, around $500 million worth of damage just in the past couple of months alone.
And meanwhile, in northern China, there's other extreme weather with very high temperatures at the moment.
Yeah, this is a tale of two extremes. So flooding in the south. In the north, we have farmers worrying that they're going to have a complete crop failure this year with rice paddies. The things that have been planted are failing. Other crops haven't even been planted yet because there's just not enough water. The north is experiencing continuous heat wave and drought. So even again, when in a place where they're used to not experiencing rain for long periods of time, they're developing things like genetically modified wheat and rice, they're worried that they'll have complete crop failure this year.
Celia Hatton reporting. We're just over a week away from the first round of voting in France's snap election, called by Emmanuel Macron after his party was trounced by the far-right National Rally in European elections earlier this month. President Macron is hoping the vote will give him a majority in Parliament. The omens for that are not looking good, though. Our correspondent Hugh Schofield has been to the president's hometown, Amiens, which is 100 miles north of Paris, to sample opinion there.
Okay, here we are. Now, today we've decided for once not to do the classic thing, which is to go to a picturesque, lovely market in the middle of town, but to come here on the outside of town, an ugly shopping commercial centre, hundreds of people around, because this is actually where most ordinary people do their shopping.
Tout ce que je sais, c'est qu'aujourd'hui, le RN, pour moi, c'est un parti comme un autre.
All I know is that today the National Rally is a party just like any other. It's a party that says it is for the French and which tries to do the maximum for the French. And we need it because, frankly, right now we're at rock bottom.
C'est le bordel en France.
France is a mess. Immigration, cost of living, nothing works. And it keeps going further downhill. Things can't get any worse than the way they are. So now is the moment to do something I have never done before and vote for the National Rally.
Bah oui, c'est la première fois que je vais voter pour le Front National.
C'est vrai qu'avant, tout ce qui était Front National...
Yes, sure, in the past, the old National Front was scary. They were racist or whatever. But things have totally changed. They're not like that at all now. If you ask me, the far left is more racist and more fascist than the National Rally.
The local MEP for Amiens was, until 2 weeks ago, Patricia Chagnon of the National Rally. Now she's running for Parliament in the elections which are coming up. One of those rare characters at the RN who actually speaks fluent English, she's not at all surprised by the big swing to her party here.
They should not be bullied by the EU, who is trying to impose regulations on them. They should not be bullied by the extreme left, who wants to totally open the French borders to everyone. They shouldn't be bullied by extreme liberalism. Our country has come to a grinding halt. And we represent the party who is going to put France back on its rails.
If the move towards the National Rally is borne out, then France is heading into completely unknown territory, with President Macron somehow having to cooperate with a prime minister from the far right. For the political scientist Bruno Courtrez, it's a recipe for instability.
If Macron first lose the election, second, that the consequence is that we have a hung parliament, many people are going to ask Macron, you should resign. Macron clearly said, I won't resign, but we could be in a situation where in the beginning, so the middle of July, it would be the Macron mandate, which is clearly on the front of the discussion.
Increasingly, here in France, it feels like the Macron era is coming to a close. It's thinking about what's going to come after that's making people very nervous.
Our correspondent, Hugh Schofield. Hawaii has announced it'll remove carbon emissions from its transport system by 2045 in order to settle a lawsuit brought by a group of young people. The details from Matt McGrath.
Hawaii is one of the most progressive states in the US on climate change, with 2045 the legal goal for reaching net zero carbon emissions. Despite this, the production of planet-warming gases in the state has been rising, going up 16% between 2020 and 2021. Concerned by this trend, a group of 13 young people brought a case, alleging the state's focus on building roads was boosting carbon and harming their right to a clean and healthy environment. The state has now agreed to settle the case and to fully decarbonise the transport system by 2045.
The Italian former football star Roberto Baggio was taken to hospital on Thursday after armed robbers broke into his family home while he was watching the Euros on television. Baggio, nicknamed the Divine Ponytail, was at one time the world's most expensive football player. Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard told me more.
Roberto Baggio was watching with his family. We don't know which of his wife and kids were there at this stage, when five armed men were said to have broken into his house. He lives in a country villa surrounded by farmland and countryside in the northeast of Italy. According to reports, he tried to resist but was bashed on the head, on the forehead, with the butt of a gun. And then he was locked in a room with his family while the gang raided his house. Apparently they've stole watches, jewellery and cash. And then when he was sure that the gang had left, he broke down the door and alerted the police himself. He was taken to hospital and treated, given stitches in the head wound, and has since been out and has been helping police with their investigations.
This is huge news in Italy because he was a huge football star.
He absolutely was, not just in Italy. He was a world star. He won the Ballon d'Or for the world's best player in 1993. He was the world's most expensive footballer, as you mentioned, when he was sold to Juventus. He played for a number of very important Italian clubs, also clubs like AC Milan, Inter Milan, Fiorentina, Bologna. And he represented Italy more than 50 times, so he's one of Italy's best goal scorers. He scored one of the World Cup's best ever goals in 1990 against Czechoslovakia, a wonderful mazy run from near the halfway line. But sadly, although he, in 1994, although he dragged Italy to the World Cup final against Brazil that year, he's perhaps best remembered for missing that the decisive penalty, blazing it over the bar, which is very sad. But beyond his footballing achievements, he's recognised for his humanitarian work. You mentioned his nickname there, the Divine Ponytail. It was partly for his very distinctive plaited ponytail that people would recognise in the 1990s, but also for the fact he adhered to Buddhism in a country that was still very much largely Roman Catholic. And he has won a Man of Peace Award from Nobel Peace Prize laureates for his humanitarian work. He also worked as an ambassador, goodwill ambassador for the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization. So a guy with lots of credit in the bank in terms of the Italian public and wider international humanitarian organizations.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard. Now, to end this edition of the Global News podcast. The sound of thousands of people watching the sunrise earlier today over the ancient standing stones at Stonehenge in southwest England. They were marking the summer solstice, the longest period of daylight in the northern hemisphere. And joining those gathered at Stonehenge was my colleague Matt Taylor from BBC Weather.
It all started last night with the sunset, a big event. That was followed on by music, dancing, a huge amount of spirituality to take you through the night and into the morning as well. But the real pinnacle was this morning, just after 10 to 5 here in the UK, in which the sun rose and shone into the centre of the stones. Now, the stones are a very important element to this, of course. And to tell me a little bit more, I'm joined by Kate Logan. She is the Historic Properties Director from English Heritage. Kate, just tell us, first of all, how important the stones are.
Stonehenge was, you know, started to be built some 5,000 years ago. And the people who built it intentionally to align with the sun on the longest day of the year. So the sun actually rises past the heel stone and shines directly into the centre of the monument. So we know the changing of the seasons and the movements of the sun were really important to Neolithic people. And so it's fantastic that today we're seeing, thousands of years later, people reconnecting with Stonehenge and gathering to celebrate the very same moment.
And it's a special day today because only twice a year people can actually get close to the stones.
Usually our visitors come and they enjoy the stones from a distance, whereas today we ask people to respect the stones, but they are allowed to get up close and to really kind of feel their energy and, you know, enjoy that moment when that sun rises and they're right in the centre.
It must be absolutely perfect weather for this. It's not guaranteed even in the middle of summer in the UK, Matt, as you know, but you couldn't have had a better start.
Skies were clear. There was a lovely mist in the valley. They call it dragon's breath as well. That dissipated. And now the sun's up. It really is starting to warm up quite nicely. And after what has been a miserable start to the summer here in the UK, a bit of sunshine, a bit of warmth is certainly welcome.
The idea of it feeling magical to be there, just describe that to me, because this is clearly what draws people to come from far and wide, to spend the night in the open air to mark this occasion. What is the kind of magical sense that it has?
I think part of it is it's a shared experience. With my job, I get up early a lot. I see many, many a sunrise. But it was just being next to such a historic monument, such as Stonehenge, in amongst everybody else, seeing that moment in time all together.
Matt Taylor at Stonehenge. And by the way, you can watch the sunrise at Stonehenge on the BBC News website. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on X, we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Tom Bartlett. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.